From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we put our questions about the Clinton health care plan to a medical ethicist and an economist. Arthur Kaplan was on the ethics working group of the Clinton health care task force. Kaplan will tell us how the plan would work and what options we could expect to have when choosing a health care program. Then we'll talk with Uwe Reinhardt about the cost of the plan and its potential impact on consumers, doctors, and the American economy. Reinhardt is a professor of political economy at Princeton University and serves on the Physician Payment Review Commission, which advises Congress. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Clinton administration launched a sales campaign for its health care program today, and there was a three-ring circus atmosphere at the White House. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
As members of the Clinton cabinet took off for points around the country, the White House itself was inundated. 60 radio talk show hosts set up camp on the North Lawn, where they were fed a steady diet of White House spinners to respond to their and their callers' questions about the plan. Out in back, on the South Lawn, a huge tent was set up for a pep rally, where the president and Mrs. Clinton spoke to 2,000 doctors, consumer advocates, and other interest groups who are supporting the plan. The White House was handing out mock health security cards, the small plastic cards they say will guarantee every American permanent health care coverage. Later today, the president flies to Florida, a state that has a large population of elderly residents, the biggest consumers of health care. Tonight, he'll participate in a televised town meeting in Tampa. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The International Olympic Committee has chosen Sydney, Australia, as the site for the Games in the year 2000. Australia's biggest city was chosen by a margin of 2 votes over Beijing, China. Chinese delegates said they were disappointed by the decision, especially since the Chinese government has campaigned for the Games as a boost to the country's international prestige. U.S. delegates expressed relief at the decision because they feared that a Chinese win might trigger calls for U.S. athletes to boycott the Beijing Games. Critics have said that China shouldn't win the Games because of human rights abuses by the Chinese government. Recovery teams working at the site of yesterday's Amtrak train accident are trying to pull the train's lead locomotive from a bayou near Mobile, Alabama. Authorities believe 3 crew members and the train's data recorder are inside. Debbie Elliott reports.
It's been a slow process recovering victims and evidence from Wednesday morning's accident that sent Amtrak Sunset Limited plunging into a swampy bayou north of Mobile. Rescue diver Mark Lampkin of Gulfport, Mississippi, is part of a team that worked overnight to pull victims from a submerged coach.
You take one section of the car, you completely search it out. When it's clear, you move to the next section, and the next section, the next section. The Amtrak provided us with blueprints and detailed drawings of the insides of the cars, so when you finish one section, you could check it off, you know it's gone, and you go on to the next.
Investigators say a barge lost in the fog may have struck and weakened the railroad bridge just before the train crossed. For National Public Radio, I'm Debbie Elliott in Mobile, Alabama.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 7 points to close at 3,539. Advances led declines by a slight margin in heavy trading of 275 million shares. This is NPR. The Clinton administration has recruited retired Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca to rally support for the North American Free Trade Agreement. After a meeting with President Clinton today in the Oval Office, Iacocca said he believes NAFTA is good for America and good for jobs. He said that NAFTA critic Ross Perot should get his facts straight before asserting that the pact will cost 5 million American jobs. White House counselor David Gergen praised Iacocca as a folk hero who has enormous credibility as someone who's a winner and who has created jobs. At least 5 people were killed and 48 others wounded in Liberia today when unidentified aircraft bombed a feeding center in a remote area of the West African country. Cindy Shiner of Africa News Service reports from Abidjan.
The attack in a remote northwest corner of Liberia was the worst breach of the ceasefire that went into effect nearly 2 months ago. Relief workers in the capital, Monrovia, said the feeding center was clearly marked. They said five people were killed and 48 others were wounded as they waited for rice. The victims were among up to 150,000 war refugees in the region. There have been reports of sporadic fighting between two rebel factions in the area for the past few weeks. Neither group is known to have aircraft. The West African peacekeeping force in Liberia has air power, but denied responsibility for the attack. Nigerian jets in the force bombed a relief convoy earlier this year, claiming it was carrying supplies to rebels. Today's bombing comes as the United Nations prepares to deploy about 500 observers to monitor the ceasefire that is supposed to end the nation's three-and-a-half-year war. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Abidjan.
Unemployment lines got longer last week as the number of newly laid-off workers applying for unemployment benefits grew by 11,000. Analysts weren't expecting such a big jump, but they said the overall trend is still pointing to continued growth in employment. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last night, President Clinton told us we must give every American health care that cannot be taken away, health care that is always there. A national debate is underway about what trade-offs we're willing to make to guarantee every American the security of health insurance. My guest, Dr. Arthur Kaplan, is a member of the Ethics Working Group of the Clinton Healthcare Task Force. He co-wrote the task force report's preamble on the ethics of health reform. Kaplan also directs the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Minnesota. I asked him if he thinks the Clinton proposal makes a trade-off between security and choice. We'd all have the security of health insurance, but in some plans, we wouldn't be able to choose our doctors.
The first thing to keep in mind is that a lot of people, the majority of Americans, have no choice. They either don't have health insurance, 37 million, they have inadequate bare minimum coverage, about another 20 million. Basically, if they get run over by a truck, they can go to some hospital for 30 days. That's it. That's what their insurance plan says. And then there are many, many more Americans who get their insurance coverage through their job, and the employer tells them what plan they've got and which doctors they will see. There is less choice out there now than people commonly think there is. It's also the case that you don't really have access to good primary care. And so when we talk about choice, most people have in mind, gosh, I want to keep my specialist. I want to keep my medical specialist, my allergist or my dermatologist or my gynecologist. And that's important. But what you really want to make sure is that you've got a system where you get to pick someone who can be your advocate and ally in all aspects of healthcare, your primary care provider. The system we've got now is way tipped, overly much so, towards specialty care. It does a lousy job of getting you a choice of primary or preventative care. That being said, what about the situation where you want to keep your doctor? I think the answer to that was obscured in the president's speech for fear of getting too far into this swamp. But to put the point clearly, if you want choice, you're going to have to pay for it. Right now, people have choice when they have generous insurance plans, when they have Cadillac coverage. They do get to pick frequently which doctor they want to see, and the doctors will accept their medical insurance. To keep that under health reform, you're probably going to have to pay a higher charge.
I'm wondering, could you outline for us what are the three basic plans, the three basic categories that the health plans will probably come under?
Mm-hmm. I think what you'll see is a first option, minimal coverage. And what that will probably mean is picking a plan with benefits that are focused on the hospital, on preventative care, at a fixed price. You'll get that plan on some sort of a basis where you probably put in about 10 to 20% of the cost, and your employer will put in about 80% of the cost.
Of the premium you're talking
yes.
about.
Mm-hmm. So if you're self-employed, you're going to have to take it out of your pocket. If you're working in a small business, they're going to have to pick up that 80%. There'll be some cycling of money around to make this all possible so that no one becomes unemployed as a result. There's some subsidy funds and so on. But that's the bare bones package. And there'll be a number of providers offering that service, depending upon where you live, who'll say, look, you can get this at this fixed price. And what this means is you get to go to our managed care plan. That is, they're going to have a network of doctors set up, and it's going to say, you got to go to one of these doctors, and you have to visit this hospital if you get very sick. So that will be the basic core minimal plan. Above that will be the kind of old fee-for-service option plan. You might decide to pay a higher premium and say, look, I want to still be able to pick my specialist for that minimum set of benefits coverage, and I want to make sure that I have some choice. They're going to give you a higher price. You get your deductible is going to be higher. There won't be a fixed premium on that. It could rise or fall depending on market forces. And that would let you basically pick a wider spectrum of doctors and a wider spectrum of health plans. The third option is what I'd call Cadillac care. And what's going to be out there for that is you'll get more benefits. If you decide you want infertility coverage, if you decide you want to be protected against needing an experimental procedure for, say, breast cancer, if you decide that you want to be picked up for long-term mental health coverage or some other things, you're going to really have to buy a much more expensive package. There will be providers out there that offer it. I don't think many people will be up in that range because most Americans won't be able to afford what's there, but I think those plans will be offered out there too. So I think you'll see a spectrum from cheapest plan, relatively limited coverage with a restriction on where you can go, all the way out to pick the Mayo Clinic if you like, and we'll fly you there in an airplane. You just give us the premiums necessary to support that.
So something that will be similar to the way it is now is that the amount of choice you have will depend on how much money you're willing to pay.
Yeah, there's no doubt that this health reform is not taking us to a egalitarian or what's sometimes called single-tier level playing field where everybody, rich or poor, gets the same level of care. My own view is that, to be fair or just, you don't have to have a uniform benefit set for everybody. What we need to do is set up a decent minimum. Everybody ought to get proven established medical care. Everybody ought to be able to get their kids their shots, well baby care, good outreach. That floor should be constructed. What people want to do with their disposable income in terms of the ceiling, how much they want to spend, whether they want to go for marginal benefits or get their care only at the finest clinics, I don't think we should prohibit it or restrict it. I don't think it violates a sense of fairness or equity. The argument should be, why don't we have a decent floor? Why don't we have a basic level of care that everybody could agree, hey, that's pretty good. If we can create that, I'm not so worried about what people are going to do with their additional money at the other end.
I'm wondering, though, if you think there will be an even further class system within the insurance system. For instance, you know, if you're getting the very basic insurance system where you're paying the minimum and you are confined to a certain list of doctors and certain hospitals, is there any reason to believe that the doctors in that plan will be as good as the doctors in, say, the Cadillac plan? Or is it going to be the kind of thing where the less money you have, the lesser qualified the doctors are going to be?
Well, I think getting at the issue of what's going to be out there in terms of quality and what you get for your money, are people going to cut corners? Is there going to be less expertise, less technology, less done on the cheap plan as opposed to the full-bore, all-out Cadillac first-class insurance plan? To be honest, I don't think you're going to eliminate differences. I think there is going to be a difference of care. The difference of care, however, should be somewhat less than the horrendous class gap that exists in the current system. I mean, what you have now is urban poor people who have access to the emergency room when they have very large holes in different parts of their bodies. Short of that, nothing. What you've got now is rural Americans who can travel 100 miles and give up the family budget maybe to get access to some hospital or primary care provider who might be willing to accept a Medicaid or a Medicare patient. Let's not kid ourselves. You're not going to get rid of class differences under the health reform proposal, but moving from a situation in which you've got a Grand Canyon-sized class distribution to one in which at least you could probably see from one end to the other in terms of the quality of care that's out there, I think that's an improvement.
My guest is Dr. Arthur Kaplan. He was a member of the Ethics Working Group of the Clinton Health Policy Task Force. He co-wrote the preamble to the report. He also directs the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Minnesota. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the proposed health policy. This is Fresh Air. Dr. Arthur Kaplan is my guest. He's a member of the Ethics Working Group of the Clinton Health Policy Task Force. Let's talk a little bit about the distribution of costs and how much treatment you're entitled to in the different plans. We've been hearing a lot about how America's healthcare system has become so expensive because of the new high tech diagnostic treatments like MRIs, because of things like heart transplants and hip replacements. Does the Clinton administration proposal call for limiting the availability of these really expensive treatments? And if so, who would be deciding who gets it and who doesn't?
That's an interesting question. I think, Terry, that's at the heart of whether this proposal is going to get anywhere in Congress and become law or not. If the American middle class and upper class think that the president is trying to ration what they're getting, diminish the quality of what they get and what level of care they get under this health reform proposal, that he's not telling the truth, he's going to cut their benefits, I hope that the president and the Congress have developed second career plans, because they will be ex-politicians very fast. The best safeguard, to be honest, against cutting back on services, against silent rationing for those who have insurance now, is their political power. And I will tell you flat out, the American people are not going to put up with the rationing of care that they've gotten used to. The president's proposal to contain costs does not involve saying, let's pull the plug on your grandmom because she's 80 years old and that's enough. It doesn't involve saying, let's cut back on who gets a pancreas transplant. It doesn't involve saying, let's throw people out the clinic door because we're unable to really give them an MRI or a CAT scan. What he's talking about is wringing out of a $1 trillion budget, close to $1 trillion, sufficient funds to bring the rest of the uninsured into the system at a decent level by getting rid of administrative waste, bloat, profiteering, and greed. Again, just to talk frankly, the system is ridden with inexcusable cost. It has people who are setting prices, the $20 aspirin, the $100 bedpan, the $2,000 a day hospital room. You've got a malpractice carnival going on out there where doctors are doing all kinds of tests, not because they think they're needed, but because they're trying to protect against lawsuit. You've got American cities, which are characterized in their architecture by having the health insurance company with the tallest building in town and more employees than anybody else, oftentimes in the city, pushing paper around. That's where the savings are supposed to come.
I think a lot of us are assuming, though, that in the cheapest basic health care plan, that there'd probably be a lot fewer people getting MRIs than in the more expensive plans.
The theory is same level of service, compete on price, compete on efficiency. Maybe you don't get the same carpeted room to get your MRI in. Maybe you're going to have a harder time parking. Maybe you're going to have to wait a bit more, but if it's needed, you get it at the same level, whether you're in the basic plan or the Cadillac plan.
Then who's defining what's needed? I mean, the standards of what's needed might be different from plan to plan.
That should not happen either. Again, and here I want to make it clear that I'm taking a side in a debate. There are some who would say about the president's plan who are inside its formulation, let the market work it out. People want to buy cheaper plans and they want to take less services. They want to take less marginal benefit. Let them buy it. That's not my view. I think we should have single standards set up about what's needed for particular types of diseases and situations with an appeals process using that health alliance system and ultimately the National Health Board to regulate what's going on. I personally don't trust the market. The president, I think, is somewhere in between. I think we're going to see this yelled about a lot in Congress. The question is, can you trust the marketplace to say there won't be any difference in the quality of care between the person buying the minimum package and the person buying the Cadillac coverage?
So what does the president say about it now, though? What does the plan say as it's drafted
The way it's written right now is that the marketplace will sort it out. I think that's not adequate. I think the president is basically saying, people of goodwill within the healthcare system will squeeze out inefficiency, will give back the money that they've been pocketing on paperwork and administrative waste. We don't have to worry about them cutting back on services, on the level and quality of what's given. I wish that were true. I don't trust it.
The biggest expenses, I've been told, medical expenses, come at the very end of life, often in the last 2 days of life, when exceptional measures are being taken to extend somebody's life. Are we going to—I know that's become part of the national debate about what our priority should be in healthcare. Does the president's plan—does Hillary's plan address that? Are we heading in a certain direction on that now with this plan?
No. Maybe we should, but it doesn't. The president's plan basically leaves the questions of expenditure at the end of life, expenditure on the terminally ill, expenditures for the elderly alone. It doesn't say anything about changing that, threatening that, modifying that. There are many people who believe that we should change that. I'm in the camp, for example, that says if you have 1.7 million Americans who die each year in hospitals, in intensive care settings, you've got a nation that doesn't know how to manage dying. Most of those people should go home. Most of those people, there's nothing to be done with them except support them, give them the psychological and pain relief and palliative support that they need. That's not in the president's plan. There's not much challenge to the way we're spending money right now, not much challenge to the idea that this is a reasonable or a just expenditure of resources. The push is on to get administrative savings. The push is on to try and drive the prices down for the delivery of those things. But the actual content of care, I'd have to say, is not going to be affected by what the president says. Maybe it should. I think that there are large areas of expenditure on people with end-stage cancer where it's horrible to have them staying, being tested and prodded and technology applied in the final days of life. I don't think we're dealing correctly with this. In fact, it's so poor that we wind up pushing people into the arms of folks like Dr. Kevorkian because they're worried that they can't escape the healthcare system. But that really is not a central feature right now of what the president's talking about. He's talking about reorganization and restructuring. He's talking about trying to drive down the prices using market forces. He's not talking at all about telling doctors from Washington or nurses from state capitals what they should and shouldn't do with particular patients.
If we're in this kind of state system where there's regulatory boards and appeal processes, won't that drive costs up in the sense that there'll be more people getting paid on those positions, there'll be more paperwork, possibly more lawsuits?
Well, two comments on that. First, the president didn't say much last night about malpractice reform. I was disappointed. He basically said he wanted lawyers to stop abusing malpractice. That may be about the most wishful statement ever made. He didn't give them any reason or incentive to do that. He just said he hoped they would be more responsible. That system's a mess. We need to fix it. There were no concrete suggestions in the president's speech about what was going to happen on that side of the street. As far as the administrative apparatus necessary to implement a market-driven, so-called managed competition approach, I think you can do it with less administration and less bureaucracy than the current private marketplace, which has thousands of insurers trying to sell coverage to zillions of providers. I think the managed competition approach will slim that down somewhat. You still are going to have a fair amount, if my side of this debate wins out, of regulatory oversight. If you push me hard, I'll come out of the closet and admit I'm for a single-payer system. I think the way to really guarantee these savings is to follow what Canada, Norway, Sweden have done and basically get the administration down to a minimum. The president last night said other European countries and Canada are spending 7%, 8%, 9% of GNP. We're spending 14%. What he didn't say was every one of those other countries has gone to a single-payer system. He's taking us halfway down the road. I'll go down that road because I think you can get savings. I wish we were going all the way down the road. I'm not sure politically that's a viable option at this time in terms of where the vested interests are, in terms of what it takes to move a trillion-dollar industry in a direction. But I think you can get some savings out of following the strategy that he outlined.
Single-payer would be who's the single-payer?
In a single-payer approach, basically the government would say, we'll collect all the premiums and we will issue the checks directly to the doctors and hospitals and providers. We're going to get rid of the private insurance middle persons. There won't be any exchange of money that way. And there may be more attempts to set premium levels and negotiate prices just between government agencies and, say, particular hospital associations, medical associations, nursing associations. That's roughly what happens in Canada at the level of each province. In the United Kingdom, it happens at the level of the county. They basically kill off these, what I can only call middlemen, who are the insurance companies and private managed care officials and administrators who are basically doing that work under the president's proposal. So I don't see any reason yet to think that we need to go that route if we really want to maximize the savings possibilities out there on the administrative bureaucracy side. And I think other countries have shown us that government can take on this function without meddling in how medicine gets done or without having to get involved in rationing and cost containment efforts that are detrimental to your health. But the president isn't ready to go that far. It doesn't sound to me like the Republicans are at all ready to let him go that far. Some of them last night were already moaning that this plan is too much in the way of government oversight. I don't agree, but as I said, I think it would be a significant improvement over the ridiculous amount of inefficiency that now exists in the current system.
Do you think, looking at your personal health insurance, do you think your policy is going to change if we go the route of the Clinton administration plan?
It's interesting. In the state that I'm in Minnesota, we're not going to see much impact of this health reform proposal of the president because we've done it. We have basically a managed competition system in place right now. We don't have an employee mandate for the small businesses that have to get it, but we do have pools available for small business to buy insurance for their employees in just the way that the president was saying his plan would let them do it more cheaply. My insurance, therefore, consists of a set of choices between a basic plan delivered by an HMO, a plan that lets me buy an HMO but with a little more choice about specialists, and a full-bore Cadillac plan that says see any doctor in the state and pay a lot more. I live with what the president, as many Minnesotans do, with what the president is already talking about. We've got about 96% universal coverage in the state under this setup. We deliver it for about a third less on average cost than what is going on in Pennsylvania, New York, or California. I think it can work. I think it can get us some savings. I don't feel vulnerable or hurt because of the style of organization of healthcare that I have to deliver here and live with. But I think it's something that perhaps gives me some enthusiasm and a little less anxiety because I've, in a sense, I've already seen what it's probably going to look like in the rest of the country just by looking around this state.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Arthur Kaplan is a member of the Ethics Working Group of the Clinton Healthcare Task Force. He directs the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Minnesota. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more on the Clinton administration's proposal for health care reform. We talk with Uwe Reinhardt, an expert on the economics of health care in America and around the world. He's a professor at Princeton University and a member of the Physician Payment Review Commission, which advises Congress on health care reform. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has been campaigning today for his health care plan after laying out its principles in a speech last night to Congress. Lawmakers will take up the plan next week when Hillary Rodham Clinton testifies before a Senate committee. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Although the House and Senate were involved in other business today, lawmakers were all talking about health care. Almost every committee and every member intends to play some role in the initiative, and there are dozens of plans being discussed. Proposals range from minor changes to the existing system to a complete redesign similar to the Canadian-style single-payer system. Some ideas put forward by Democrats have less in the way of government intervention than Republican proposals. But members are in agreement on the underlying goal of universal coverage, and Republicans and Democrats have all been emphasizing the need for compromise. The administration has also deliberately left some gray areas in its plan to encourage debate. Louisiana Democrat John Breaux, who has his own proposal, said the fact that the White House has not submitted detailed legislation yet is a sign that the president intends to be flexible. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin has called for early presidential elections to be held next June. After disbanding parliament earlier this week, Yeltsin called for new elections to be held in December to choose a new parliament. It's unclear if Yeltsin plans to run for re-election himself. There are also indications that Yeltsin is becoming impatient with hardliners barricaded inside the parliament building in Moscow. He has ordered police to secure public safety and accused his opponents of handing out guns to anti-government demonstrators. The U.S. Marine Corps is grounding all of its aircraft for a 48-hour safety inspection period next week. These orders come after a spate of accidents in recent weeks that left 11 Marines and one civilian dead. NPR's Martha Raddatz has that story.
The Marine Corps says it will halt operations of its airplanes and helicopters next Monday and Tuesday. Until then, only flights deemed essential by commanders will be allowed. The stand-down order affects over 1,100 reserve and active duty aircraft. Since August 17th, there have been four separate accidents involving six Marine Corps helicopters, and just yesterday, a Harrier jet crashed at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. Marine Corps Commandant Carl Mundy said in a statement that the mishaps have occurred for a variety of reasons and that no one factor stands out. But, said the Commandant, the safety inspection period will allow commanders to look at training standards, personal qualifications, and maintenance practices. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 7 points to close at 3,539.75 on volume of more than 275 million shares. This is NPR News. Top U.S. officials have called for a change in the way that the U.N. decides on peacekeeping operations around the world and at the same time place new limits on how the U.S. takes part in these operations. U.N. envoy Madeleine Albright says that the larger the U.N. peacekeeping operation, the more likely it is that American troops will be serving under U.S. commanders. She also said that the U.S. will never give up its right to use unilateral force to protect its vital interest and its citizens, but that more flexibility is needed in a post-Cold War period. Former Chrysler chairman Lee Iacocca met with President Clinton today, and he signed on to the Clinton administration's campaign for the North America Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The administration is hoping that Iacocca's endorsement of NAFTA and his public appeal can help counter Ross Perot's high-profile campaign against the free trade agreement. After the meeting with the president, Iacocca said he still didn't know what his role will be, but he resisted the idea of a debate with Perot.
I'm not countering anybody. I'm not Democrat. I'm not Republican. I'm not for Perot, against Perot. I'm for America. I'm a retired businessman. I've worked hard. I understand labor. I understand their concerns. I'd like to talk to some of them.
Still, Iacocca said that Perot is on the wrong side of the angels, suggesting that the Texas billionaire plays fast and loose with the facts.
I think he should get some facts put together. I think it's got to be more factual than it's been.
Without mentioning Perot, Iacocca said NAFTA opponents are playing on the fears of Americans. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Sydney, Australia has been chosen as the site for the Summer Olympics in the year 2000 and being named the host city. Sydney won out over Beijing, Manchester, Berlin, and Istanbul. Sydney's victory came after two previous bids for the 1992 and 1996 Games. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today we're all trying to understand how the Clinton health care plan would affect the quality of health care and the price we pay for it. We invited Uwe Reinhardt to analyze the plan. Reinhardt is an expert on health care policy in the U.S. and around the world. He's a professor of political economy at Princeton University and serves on the Physician Payment Review Commission, which advises Congress on medical payments to doctors, malpractice, and health care reform. Under the Clinton program, there would be three types of health insurance plans. An HMO-type plan would be the cheapest, but you would be limited to the doctors who are part of the organization. In a preferred provider plan, you would also be part of a group, but for an extra fee, you could consult outside doctors. The most expensive plan, fee-for-service, would offer free choice of doctors and hospitals. Some people are concerned that with the basic HMO plan, you not only wouldn't be able to choose your doctor, but your doctor might spend less time with you and be pressured to cut corners to save money.
There is the potential for that, to be sure, although doctors on fee-for-service who want to charge a lot of fees hurry you in and out as well. We shouldn't overlook that. But there is no question that when a physician or group of physicians get paid a lump sum at the beginning of the year, and for that they owe you all necessary health services, there is the danger that they will underserve you, that they will not give you a CAT scan when perhaps it should have been given, or they will hurry you in and out in order to meet a prescribed quota of patients per day. That is definitely a possibility.
How do other countries handle choice when it comes to doctors?
Other countries will have give their patients more choice. In Canada, for example, you get an insurance card. When you are sick, you have completely free choice of doctor and hospital in your community. You're not confined to any plan. That is so in France, and it is so in Germany, and it is so in Holland. This locking in of patients into a health plan is a uniquely American thing.
As President Clinton pointed out last night, we're spending about 14% of the gross national product on our health care, whereas a lot of other countries are spending 9% and guaranteeing their citizens a lot more than what we're guaranteed. Why are costs so high in the United States? And then we'll see if you think that this new proposal addresses those problems.
There are three factors I could mention. The first one, in defense of our medical system, it is asked to do jobs that Canadian and German healthcare providers don't have to serve. And that is to serve as the vacuum cleaner that sweeps off our streets the social pathos our lifestyle begets. In Canada, teenagers don't have submachine guns. We allow this. Not legally, but, you know, teenagers have them. They don't have the crack problem, so we do have more trauma. Secondly, our providers, our doctors, our nurses, and our health economists, if I may add, are better paid than our counterparts in Germany, France, or the United States. Everyone who works in healthcare is very well paid in this country, and that adds money. And thirdly, our system is so horrendously complex and paper-happy that we spend billions, probably $100 billion, needlessly on paperwork that other countries simply don't tolerate. They run their systems on the principle KISS, keep it simple, stupid. The American way is always to make everything very complex, and that costs money.
Okay, so under the Clinton proposal, do we solve any of these problems? We won't solve the Uzi problem. We won't solve the problem of teenagers with automatic weapons in the streets. You also said doctors get paid more here than in other countries. Does the Clinton administration proposal address that? Is that something you think we should change in the first place?
Well, there isn't that much mileage in it, but I do believe that doctors will get paid less under the Clinton plan, particularly specialists who got used to the $300,000-$500,000 net income. They will see that whittled away probably in half. Primary care specialists, internists, general practitioners probably will see their income stable or even go up a little bit, but the super specialists will see their income decline. There will be some reduction in the paper war, but not as much as the president supposes. Your typical for-profit health maintenance organization now burns about 20 cents of every premium dollar on administration, marketing, and profits. That is, for every dollar premium a business or families pay to an HMO, only 80 cents buys health care. That is an awful lot of paper still, and unless they manage to get this down, ours will still be the most paper-hungry, administratively top-heavy health system in the world.
Do you think the Clinton proposal would work financially? Do you think the numbers work out?
If I had to bet my own money, I would say these are probably optimistic estimates. But if I were on the Clinton team, I'd, with a straight face, defend them because you have actuaries who sign off on them. Historically, these actuaries have always been wrong. They underestimated the cost of the Medicare program vastly. They vastly underestimated the cost of the renal dialysis program. My sense is they are vastly underestimating the cost of this program as well. But politically, you have to start somewhere, and if I were working for the president, I would, with a straight face, defend these numbers.
My guest is Uwe Reinhardt, and he's a professor of political economy at Princeton University. He also serves on the Physician Payment Review Commission, which advises Congress on Medicare payments as well as health care policy and health reform. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Clinton administration health care policy proposal, and my guest is Uwe Reinhardt, who is a professor of political economy at Princeton University. Something else that's responsible for the high cost of health care is all the new high-tech diagnostic machinery that we have, like MRIs, and the new high-tech surgeries like hip replacement, and the extraordinary measures that we're able to take to extend life. This is all very expensive. Is that or should that be addressed in a health policy?
Well, the beauty of the concept of managed competition is that you don't have to address it in a fishbowl and this debate openly or not, will we allow this procedure, will we pay for this procedure or not, because the health maintenance organizations, the health plans, they will make a lot of these choices in the confines of their boardrooms and their clinics. So an awful lot of these decisions to withhold or not to withhold are done on an ad hoc basis, invisibly, and therefore don't become a political hot potato. That is, of course, the idea. There should be no mistake about it. The intent is that ultimately such a system will ration health care in the sense that it leads to the withholding of beneficial health care. But I would also add, and this will shock you, every economist with a PhD would tell you that the optimal health system is one that rations health care.
Why?
This is what we teach, because we say the optimal system is one that goes only to the point where the extra benefit from an additional procedure covers the extra cost. Since these costs are always positive, you can actually prove that in an optimal state, you will withhold procedures that were marginally beneficial. It simply said, yes, they are beneficial, but they're not worth the cost. Concretely explained, you go with a headache to a doctor, you've had it for 2 weeks. You are worried. The doctor said, I think you're okay. However, if I did an MRI, we would even know more about what's going on inside your head. But I think you are right. You see, an economist would say probably at the margin, the $1,000 cost of that MRI isn't justified by the extra certainty. That's how an economist would reason, at least as long as that economist is vertical and not the patient.
Right.
Patients, of course, view this quite differently.
But this is, instead of making decisions like this, in terms of, like, ethical debate, it's more of, like, bottom-line debate.
Absolutely, yes.
Is that the way to do it?
Well, yes, that is the way economists would advocate it should be done. There should be an organization that is forced through a budget, the capitation that patients pay in, to make these hard calls as they go.
Do you think we're going to have a class system within the insurance system?
Oh, I think so. I think over time it'll develop that, particularly as healthcare becomes ever more expensive and the politicians pull the purse strings for subsidies to the poor ever tighter. I think there is no question in my mind that ultimately the managed competition structure will give you a tiered system, tiered by income class. Maybe that's its advantage. I have come to conclude that Americans would never accept an egalitarian health system, that the only thing they'd ever accept is something that gives the well-to-do their Disneyland in medicine and yet does not force the well-to-do to subsidize for the poor such expensive Disneyland care. And managed competition gives you that.
If you're unemployed, who is actually paying for your policy and how much will you have to pay yourself?
Under the Clinton plan, if you are unemployed, you would have to register with the Health Alliance, and they would charge you a premium that is pegged on your income. If you're dirt poor, you basically get totally free care. You just register, you get a card, you are fully insured, you can choose an HMO, and the cost of that is simply smeared over everyone else who is in that Health Alliance.
Now, I know we have probably a disproportionately high number of freelance writers and artists listening today. What kind of deal do they get under the new system?
Well, they get the same deal. They would have to, by law, register with the Health Alliance, and they would have to have a card. That would be the law. Not to do that would be as illegal as not paying income taxes. Now, a freelance artist, for example, who makes $20,000, would have to go to the Alliance and pay a premium. Maybe on an annual basis, they would say you should contribute at least 8% of your income or 6% of your income. And they would have to write a check for that amount. And the rest would be absorbed by the Health Alliance. They would actually get a federal subsidy out of a federal pot for that shortfall.
So it would depend on their income?
It would depend on their income, and particularly those people would be infinitely better off under the Clinton plan. Although, see, for instance, when you go to a TV studio, you get makeup put on. Those are usually freelancers. And I always ask, are you insured? And almost always they say, no, I can't afford the premium.
Mm-hmm.
Well, under the Clinton plan, they'll be both better and worse off. Worse off in the sense they must buy this card at X percent of the income. They may have to lay out $1,500, which now they don't spend at all. But now, if they wanted insurance, they might have to pay $3,000. Well, the Clintons will give it to them for $1,500. So in some respects, they're better off. But the fact that they have to, by law, buy the card may make some of them feel put upon.
So it's interesting. So you have no choice. You'd have to be insured.
Absolutely. And I agree totally with the president's analysis of that. This freeloading of saying, I'm a healthy yuppie, I'm not going to pay insurance, and then you get hit by a car and you're a $200,000 case and everyone else but you pays, that really isn't fair.
My guest is Uwe Reinhardt, professor of political economy at Princeton University. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. Later today on All Things Considered, we'll be talking about the president's health care proposals with some of the people we met during the course of the presidential campaign. They were in New Hampshire, now they're all around the country, and they have some very decided opinions about what the president's plan will do for them, and some very real concerns about how it will be financed. It's Sydney for the Summer Olympic Games. We'll ask, whose summer, Sydney's or ours? We are watching closely the situation in Russia. President Boris Yeltsin has called for presidential elections by June, and the situation is still tense there. And we will talk about Emancipation Day dinner with Edna Lewis. That's later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
My guest is Uwe Reinhardt, a professor of political economy at Princeton University and an expert on healthcare policy in the U.S. and around the world. Let's look at the HMO part of this system, the part that would be least expensive, where you'd have minimal choice of doctors. I'm sure everybody is wondering, what will the quality of medical care be in that bottom tier of the program? Will there be incentives for doctors to participate in such a program? What would be in it for the doctors to be in the HMO-type program as opposed to a program where they could see probably the wealthier clients who have unlimited choice?
Well, for one, the market can only absorb so many doctors who cater only to wealthy people, because God has arranged the world so that there are few wealthy people. So there are limits to what to the number of doctors who can clip toenails for rich people. Most of them will have to find work in HMOs of various sorts, and there are also many American doctors who actually are ethically driven to help the poor. Let's not forget that. Doctors don't just go after money. There are many, many doctors.
That's very true, and I'm glad you're saying
that. Yeah, who really want to help patients. So I wouldn't worry about that, nor would I worry about the notion that low-cost HMOs are necessarily low-quality HMOs. There's actually not that clear a relationship between how much we spend on healthcare and how much what the quality is. The president pointed out the fascinating Pennsylvania data that shows that the clinical outcome of coronary bypass surgery is completely unrelated to what you pay for that.
Is there something you would worry about instead?
Well, I would worry a little bit about whether the low-cost HMO has all of its facilities in low-income areas and is staffed chiefly with foreign medical graduates whose language facility may not match the patients that they serve. I would worry about the quality of the facilities. How long do you have to wait for a CAT scan and an MRI? You know, there are indicators you could look at to see whether these HMOs are welching or not. That is, of course, what the accountability part is supposed to take care of. There are supposed to be surveys by the Health Alliance of each plan's patients where they are supposed to mark down, are you satisfied with the service, the way we have it in hotels. And there are ultimately, in the 21st century, to be clinical outcome studies where you actually say, in this cheap HMO, do patients who get coronary bypass surgery there die at a higher rate than in HMOs whose premiums are higher? So that you can actually say whether the clinical quality is related to the premium. So, you know, there are these safeguards in it, at least in theory. How this works in practice is an open question, I'd have to admit.
So you think that there might be a kind of neighborhood-by-neighborhood difference in HMOs, that the HMO clinics in the poor, the HMO programs in the poorer neighborhoods might not be as good as the ones in the more middle-class neighborhoods?
Yes, I would say that unambiguously, and I only have to look at New Jersey's high schools. If you look at schools in where I live, Princeton, West Windsor, those schools are actually cheaper than the inner-city schools, and yet if you look at the plan, it is a horror case in the inner cities or in New York. And that's something that one does have to worry about. Very often, human services facilities in low-income areas are actually more expensive than in well-to-do areas.
Well, as you said, there's supposed to be some kind of monitor to make sure that good health care is guaranteed to people. What kind of confidence do you have in a system that would monitor the health care programs?
Well, again, you know, one does not want to argue against the president, and given he's worked so hard on it, wish him well. But when you look at the public school system, it is discouraging. All these monitors are supposed to be there. And yet, I know in a New Jersey case very well, the most expensive schools have the worst outcomes, the worst plant, and you ask, who are the monitors? It ultimately depends on the quality of the people who do the monitoring. Who is going to staff the health alliances that the states are to create? Are they the same kind of people who run the New York City School Board or the New Jersey School Boards? If so, I can only say wish us luck. Or are there people of a superior cut?
When you look at the pros and the cons of the Clinton healthcare proposal, do you end up supporting it?
I would end up supporting it because I view it, I always say it's the best, second best solution in my view. I think if you compare, suppose project yourself to the year 2005, and suppose we go down this path that the president has mapped out, and supposing Canada stays on its system, which is very simple, gives people free choice of doctor when they're sick, but the Canadians spend more. Supposing the Canadians by the year 2005 spent, say, 13% of the GDP on healthcare, and we with our system spent 17%. I'm utterly convinced that the Canadian doctors and patients both would be happier than American doctors and patients will be in this very complicated system. But I also am convinced that the United States simply would never adopt a Canadian-style system. There are some things other countries can culturally afford that we just cannot do. And therefore, this may be the best that we can get through the Congress, and therefore I support it.
And it will be an improvement over what we have now?
It'll be a vast improvement over what we have now. I was on a Canadian television program this morning, and I said, basically, we're in a swamp with alligators, and Clinton is trying to lead us out of that. And to that extent, I think he really has made a major contribution. President Bush, by contrast, it was well known that he said to his staff, look busy, but don't do anything. This is a swamp I don't want to get into. But he didn't realize he was already in it. And that is, of course, I think one major reason he lost the election. He thought health reform leads him into a swamp. Clinton understood we're in a swamp and we have to lead people out. And I think that's why he won. And that is why he honorably owns up to it. And whether you agree with every detail, I salute him for it and I thank him for doing what he did.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Uwe Reinhardt is a professor of political economy at Princeton University. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenlease and Sue Spolin, research assistance from Peter Clowney. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of investment companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Fresh Air, Seinfeld. The sitcom just won 3 Emmys, and Jerry Seinfeld's new book is a bestseller. We'll feature a 1987 interview with Jerry Seinfeld and more recent interviews with Larry David, co-creator of the sitcom, and Jason Alexander, who co-stars as George. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.